Hi, reader. I'm Cindy Burnett. Welcome to my award-winning podcast, Thoughts from a Page, which is a member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. On the show, I chat with authors whose books I have enjoyed about their new releases, and I give you a peek behind the curtain of the publishing industry with my Behind the Scenes series. With so many books coming out weekly, it can be hard to decide what to read, so I find the best ones and share them with you. If you're looking for a community of readers, bonus content, and a chance to read books before they hit the shelves, I hope you'll consider joining my Patreon group, which is filled with a wonderful bunch of book lovers. The link to join is in the show notes. Today, Claire McIntosh returns to chat about I Promise It Won't Always Hurt Like This. Claire lost her son 18 years ago when he was just 5 weeks old. I knew a little bit about her story, but as soon as I saw that she was putting out this book on grief, I knew I had to read it. As most of you know, I lost both of my parents in the last couple of years, and it has been a real struggle for me. I haven't been able to pick up many books on grief yet, but I did decide, because I love Claire's fiction, that I was going to try this one, and I'm so glad I did. If you are struggling with grief yourself, or you know someone who is, this book will be perfect for you or for them. Claire is a former police officer and a multi-award-winning author. She has spoken on television and radio about the death of her son and the themes of grief and healing, which consequently appear in her novels. She lives in North Wales with her family. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor. So while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
Welcome, Claire. How are you today?
I'm really well. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. I always love chatting books with you. And normally we have been talking about your thrillers, but today we're going to go in a different direction. You have a book coming out on grief.
I do, yes. It feels a bit scary, I suppose, is the word, I think, to be talking about something that is closer to me than my fiction. So I feel comforted by the fact that I'm in safe hands with you.
Absolutely. And your book really resonated with me. I have lost both my parents in the last couple of years. And so it's hard sometimes, I think, to dive into some of these books that are on grief. But on the other hand, I recognize so much in what you wrote, and that was so comforting to me.
I'm glad to hear that. And I'm so sorry for your loss. Grief is something that touches all of us at some point. And certainly now, so I'm in my late 40s, and there are few of my peers who have not been affected by the loss of a parent, a partner, a friend, perhaps a child. And that means that we should be having a lot more conversations about it. And, you know, I'm sure you feel the same, that one of the best ways to have conversations about these things are through books.
I agree. And the thing that really stuck with me about your book is exactly what you're saying, the conversations, because I feel like generally in society, grief is dealt with as a short-term thing. You lose somebody, you're sad for a little while, and then everything keeps going. And it's just not that way at all for those that are knee-deep in the grief.
No, grief changes your identity, I think. And that doesn't have to be as negative as it sounds. I mean, I know, you know, I'm sort of thinking about how grief has changed me over the years, that actually I'm a much kinder and more empathetic person than I was before I experienced a loss. And so it's really something that is finite, I suppose, what I'm trying to say. It will live with us forever. And what we do is we find ways of changing and living with it rather than trying to fight it.
Exactly. Though sometimes I don't do the very best job with that. I often do try to fight it. I shouldn't, but I do.
the bottom line is you have to do what you need to do to get through each day. And in the early stages of grief, and I'm putting great big inverted commas around early stages, because that might be days, weeks, months, it might be a few years that you're still in the early stages of grief. It's all about survival. And then you move to a point where you're not just surviving, you're thriving. But if in the early stages, what it means is you have to shut it away and not think about it for a bit while you get on with your day-to-day life, then I think that's okay.
I agree. I think that the purpose of your book, and also just generally trying to understand grief, is realizing everybody has a different journey and you have to find the ways that you can get through the day.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's back up a little bit. And will you just tell me a little bit about, I promise it won't always hurt like this for those that haven't read it yet.
Yes. So the book started actually from something that I posted online. So I lost my son 18 years ago. And on the 14th anniversary of his death, I forgot the day, which was something that had never happened before. And I realized midway through the day that it was Alex's day. It was the anniversary of his death. And in realizing that, it dawned on me how far I'd come and how I was thriving now and not just surviving. And so I shared some thoughts on what was then Twitter about the way grief had evolved for me over the years. And I offered some promises for the way grief might look for other people. And the thread went viral, and thousands of people messaged me with their stories of grief and of hope. And when I couldn't reply to them all, I wrote a book. And so I Promise It Won't Always Hurt Like This is a memoir, but it's also a conversation between me and the reader. It's a promise of better times ahead. It's divided into 18 promises, and each of them look at what I think of as a different symptom of grief, because grief for me is like a kind of illness. It's something that we live with in the way that we live with a chronic illness. And at times that illness has flare-ups, and some symptoms are worse than others. And so the promises look at things like, I promise you'll be able to sleep again. I promise that you won't always wake up in the morning and grief will be your first thought. I promise that you'll be able to take a breath without feeling as though someone's sitting on your chest. It's those sorts of things. And I hope very much that it brings comfort to readers.
Well, I can say personally, it definitely brought a lot of comfort to me and dove into some things that I don't even know how to exactly word it, but things that are on my mind and that I struggle with, like the guilt or the dreaming, things like that, that, you know, you wake up and you've had this dream and then you realize, ugh, I'm back to where I was.
Oh, it's awful, isn't it? I can never really decide what's worse, whether it's worse to dream about them dying or to dream that they're still alive and enjoy that moment, that special, special, precious moment in your dreams of having them back, but then to have to live through that loss when you wake up. It's it feels so cruel. But I think it's about reframing those difficult times. I was thinking the other day about how quite often I still want to call my dad. So my dad died more than 10 years ago now. And yet there are moments, particularly actually when I'm writing, I normally write crime fiction, as you know, and my father was a pathologist, and I will often be writing a scene and think, oh, I need to ask my dad how that happens. Or I need to tell him about this. Or it feels so cruel that your mind plays those tricks on you. But what I've done more recently is reframed it that actually, what a joy, what a treat it is to have that reminder, for them to be so close to us still, to be in our hearts and in our heads, so much so that they're still living within us. So I think a lot of it is about coming to terms with the fact that these difficult moments aren't necessarily going to go away, but we will look at them slightly differently.
And that's a great way to approach it, because I often still think, oh, I've got to tell my mom that. and it's difficult.
Yeah, it is. It is really hard. I think writing can help, particularly if, you know, if you had a really close relationship with a parent or a friend and you had conversations with them all the time, then to have a special book, a notebook where you write those things down. And every time you think, oh, I must send a message or I must give her a ring or I must let him know about that. If you write it instead, write them a letter. And then what you have is a conversation that you can keep going and you can, you know, put in a drawer. But I think it's a very cathartic way of processing that.
That's a great idea. I often think she's looking down and realizing how much I miss her and that that is a good sign that she knows how close we were.
Definitely. Definitely. Look, I'm not a religious person. I don't have a strong faith. And I am fairly, scientific, pragmatic in my life in general. I find it quite difficult to believe in fate or other worlds, but big but, I firmly believe that our loved ones can see us. I am absolutely convinced that my dad knows that I left the police, that I became this successful author. I think he knows that I'm happy and that I have these amazing kids. I think that my son, who was only 5 weeks old when he died, that he knows what his big brother's doing, what his siblings are doing, that he would be very proud of his mom.
I think that's exactly right. And I like that. And I'm going to take a slight divergence here because you are a crime fiction writer. And I just wanted to mention how much I love all of your books. I've interviewed you several times. And you have another one that's coming out in April, A Game of Lies, which I just think is fabulous. In fact, my Patreon group is doing an early read and we're meeting with you ahead. But I just want to make sure I give it a shout out and tell everybody they need to make sure they read it.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to my American readers getting this one. It's been so weird because it's quite a long gap. So A Game of Lies came out in the summer of 2023 in the UK. And so for me, it's kind of, you know, I finished talking about that. I finished doing my events. But in April, I'm coming over to the States and to Canada to tour with A Game of Lies and also talking about I Promise. And it's just going to be so brilliant to meet with my American readers.
Absolutely. And I will tell you that I was so excited for that book. And I saw that it had come out in the UK in July. So I just ordered it and read it really early here because I was so excited for it. And it is phenomenal.
Oh, you are lovely. Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a very odd year for me as a writer in 2022 because I wrote both these books. So I wrote I Promise and A Game of Lies in the same year. And obviously they're very, very different books, but it was actually very helpful because I needed to take breaks from writing my memoir in the same way that I think we need to take breaks from our grief, right? We can't live with our grief front and center all the time, because if we did, we would break. We have to be able to shut it away and put on a brave face. Again, those inverted commas doing a lot of work there. Put on a brave face, get out there, chat to people, talk to our friends, have some semblance of normal, happy life. We need to do that. And so I found that when I was writing, I could write a section, a scene, a conversation of, I promise it won't always hurt like this. But then I needed to set it to one side. And it was then a joy to go back to the manuscript for A Game of Lies, to immerse myself in the twisty, sort of quite fun life of crime fiction and the fictional characters that I'd created there. And so I spent 2022 juggling the two projects, which seemed quite a weird thing to be doing because they were so different, but actually was very, very good for me.
I can see that it would be nice to toggle between the two.
Yeah, did you ever find that when you're reading that you read one genre for a really long time, but then you sort of need a bit of a palate cleanser with something else?
Absolutely. And I also find with nonfiction, not your book so much, but like narrative nonfiction, that a lot of times I can read a chapter or two and then I'll read something fiction, then I'll go back to the nonfiction. That kind of helps me at times. So yes, I think that definitely makes sense that you have to vary it up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about how you decided to structure this book. It is 18 chapters, Assurances on Grief. Is that always how you plan to structure it?
It's always how I plan to structure it because I wanted to structure it around individual promises. I didn't have a number in mind. I was just writing the promises as I thought of what I wanted to say. And then as we came closer to completion of the book, I realized it would be 18 years since I've been living with grief, and that felt like a very fitting shape to the book. And so, yeah, 18 promises, one for each year that I've lived without my son. But the reason I've structured it, so there are different ways that I could have approached this. It is, in essence, a memoir. And quite often people structure memoirs by starting at the beginning and taking the reader through that section of their life. And so what I could have done is to start with the main event, start with the cause of my grief, my son's loss, and then to take you through the next 18 years and sort of show you this gradual healing. But actually, I don't think that would be useful. I found it very, very difficult to read when I was new to grief. I found I couldn't concentrate for very long. I certainly would have found it difficult to hold in my head an 18-year sort of journey. And also, sometimes you need a quick hit of hope. And making someone wait for 18 years before things feel better seems like a peculiar sense of cruelty. What I Promise It Won't Always Hurt Like This does is it gives you 18 self-contained narratives. So you can open one of those promises and you can read a little bit about how things were in the beginning, and then you can see how things are now and how I got from one state to the other. And that means that if you are someone who is struggling to concentrate, or you just need a little hand-holding for an hour before you do something or before you try and sleep, that you can open it at any chapter and have that sort of complete story in a few pages.
I agree with that. And also, as a reread, if there are certain things with your grief that you're still struggling with, you can be like, oh, I remember I read that one chapter in Claire's book. It really resonated with me. I'm going to pull it right back out and read it again, and that's going to help. And so I think that is nice.
Yes, absolutely. And you can miss bits out, because I think that's really important as well, that sometimes what I'm writing in here isn't going to apply to you. And if that's the case, or it makes you cross, you know how some bits, especially when you're grieving, I mean, gosh, my anger was off the charts in the early years of my grief. And if something makes you angry, like you want to throw the book across the room, then you, well, A, you know, do that. I don't mind if the book gets damaged. But also you can just skip that whole chapter and know that you're not missing like 5 years of the story, or you're just missing commentary about a particular symptom of grief. And maybe that symptom isn't yours.
Exactly. Or every loss is so different that losing a child is different than losing a parent. And so maybe you haven't experienced one of these things just because the losses are so different. So I do think, and of course you did lose your dad as well, but I think depending on which chapter and what you're talking about, it might not necessarily be relevant to somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, what I always say is that loss is universal, but grief is unique. Two people don't feel grief in the same way. Even when I think about how my sisters and I felt after my dad died, we grieved in very, very different ways. And you can't expect somebody else to know exactly how you're feeling. And I think that's why grief can feel so incredibly lonely.
I think that's right. And you're actually leading me into my next thought, because you write about you and your husband and how you each had your own path in grief, and that while you're so immersed in your own grief, you can't be trying to hold somebody else up. And I found that my sister and I were that way. Like, she was really struggling, but so was I. And I wasn't in a headspace to try to be able to help her. Now I am. But for a while, I just felt like it was all I could do to get through my days. And you have to kind of give yourself some grace for that.
You really do. It's like two drowning people. You know, you're just going to pull each other under. What you need is someone in a boat.
Yes, that's actually a great analogy. But that's right. You need to be dealing with somebody who's not so immersed in theirs that they can kind of help you as you're going along. And it's isolating. And you talk about that as well, that you and your sister later spoke and she said, you know, you just didn't want help. And I think sometimes that's right. You kind of want to wall yourself off for a little while.
Yeah, I found it really difficult. I genuinely thought that people were avoiding us. And do you know, I don't know. Maybe some, you know, some people definitely were, but I had that conversation with my sister and said, you know, we were so lonely. No one called, no one reached out. You just sort of abandoned us. And she said, no, we tried. We tried so, so hard. And you kept pushing us away. And regardless of sort of where the truth lies in that, and I guess, you know, it lies somewhere in the middle, it's all about perception. We perceived that people were ignoring us, and other people perceived that we didn't need help. And so somehow you have to try and break through that. And it's one of the reasons why I think books are so incredibly important, because sometimes when people offered me support or help, it was at the wrong time. Whereas with a book, it's always there. You know, you can put it next to your bed, you can ignore it for months on end, but when you need it, all you've got to do is pick it up and start turning the pages. And that's so much more useful, I think. Even when you've got friends that you know you could call at any time, it's still not as immediate as a book.
I agree, because often I would struggle in the middle of the night and I would feel terrible calling somebody at 2 a.m. But to just have the book, pick it up, read that helps recenter, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Well, what about writing about yourself and trying to get all of this down on the page versus writing thrillers as you have in the past? Did you find that to be drastically different? I mean, I'm assuming yes.
Yes.
I mean, I guess that's kind of a silly question, but I just am interested in the differences, I guess.
So I don't think it's a silly question at all, because although there are lots and lots of differences, there are actually some similarities as well. So structurally, it was very different. As I've said, I sort of took the decision not to structure it in a linear narrative fashion. Whereas, of course, my novels are, they cover a period of time. So that was very different. I was obviously writing about real people rather than fictional ones. But you know what? When I'm writing fiction, I am trying to create characters that feel like they could walk off the page. You know, with my latest crime novels that all feature the same detective, I want readers to feel as though they know Detective Constable Fionn Morghan. And so that process of making a character three-dimensional is kind of, you know, the same. Although actually in my memoir, I took a decision very early on that I wanted to keep a very light touch whenever I was talking about other people. And that was partly because I wanted it to be a very intimate conversation between me and the reader. I didn't want to bring lots and lots of people into it, but also because I wanted to respect the privacy of my friends and family and, you know, their and my children, my surviving children, because my grief is not their grief and their grief is not my story to tell. So I wasn't talking about lots and lots of people in the memoir, but there are still, you know, bringing prose to life is the same, I think, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. You want the reader to feel as though they're walking the same path as you. And in that respect, I think I found it a fairly similar process.
And you touch on this, and I always find it such an interesting aspect of writing memoir, is that obviously you're telling your story, but you can't tell your story in a vacuum. You have family, you have friends, you have your sister, you have people that are going to be brought into the story. And so you have to be sensitive to them and your portrayal of them. And you do mainly focus on your grief. But I was just kind of curious, did you talk with your husband a lot about it? Did he read it ahead? How did all of that work for you?
He has read he doesn't want to read the whole thing, and I respect that. He has read the passages where he is mentioned. My sisters have read the passages where they're mentioned, and my mother has read the passages where she's mentioned. And that was important because I needed them to know exactly what I was planning to publish. I sent them the printed pages, and you know, I'd spoken to them about it, but I didn't want answers, sort of, I didn't want them to feel on the phone or face to face like they had to say yes. So I wrote to them and enclosed the pages, and I said, this is what, you know, what I want to write. but it can all be changed. It can all be deleted. It, you know, if you have any qualms about this, if it makes you feel uncomfortable at all, then that's far more important to me than what's going in the finished book. So, but actually there weren't any changes to make. So it was all fine.
That's always just so fascinating to me because everybody approaches it differently. And there's nothing in this book that I would think any of them would find offensive, but it's nice to at least give them the opportunity to say, okay, yes, I'm comfortable with this. I'm not comfortable with this. But everybody approaches that differently.
They do. And do you know what? Now that I've written this, I cannot imagine writing what I would call a proper memoir. So this, you know, I promise is it fits in that space somewhere between memoir and self-help. But, you know, and let's call it an autobiography. I cannot imagine writing an autobiography where you are detailing conversations and incidents that have happened with people. I can't imagine the legal process of that. And I can't imagine how it would sit with me ethically to, you know, you read these sort of, say, a celebrity autobiography that's all full of kiss and tell moments. And I know it has to go through legal, but I'm still amazed by what's allowed to be printed.
I agree. I'm always completely intrigued by this. And so I always wonder how people approach that. And it's interesting to hear. And you're right. I mean, your story is different because you're dealing with grief and all of that. But it's just so fascinating to me to hear how people approach it. And it's so widely different.
It is. It is.
Well, did anything surprise you when you wrote this one?
I was surprised by how hard it was to write and how much I cried, which perhaps on the face of it shouldn't be surprising. I mean, you know, people are probably listening to this thinking, well, duh, it's a memoir about losing your son. Of course, it's going to be upsetting. But I'm kind of, you know, I thought I was better. That was sort of the point of writing the book was, yay, look, you know, look how far I've come. Look how much I've grown in my grief. What happened was I wrote the first draft and it was kind of okay. It was quite cathartic. It was a little sad in places, but I found it an okay process. And my editor said, this is great. This is going to be a really important book. I'm really proud to be publishing this. Now for the second draft, I need you to dig deeper. And she marked on the manuscript places where she wanted me to just explore those emotions a bit more, to talk a little bit more about how that had really felt back then, and perhaps give some illustrative scenes that really sort of showed how life was. And that was hard. And so I would do that and I would dig deep, and the digging deeper brought out grief that I just hadn't realized was still there, that I guess I hadn't dealt with. And that was really hard. And it did take me by surprise. The other thing that I hadn't expected was not being able to write this book, A, for as long as I might normally write. So if I'm writing fiction, I might write for hours on end. And I couldn't do that with I Promise. I could write for an hour tops, maybe. And also that I couldn't write a lot of it in my house. And I realized that actually quite early on, that when I was writing the sad bits of this book, I didn't want to be in my house because my house is a really happy place. I didn't live here when I was in the early years of my grief. This house has only known happiness. I'm touching a lot of wood now and crossing fingers. It's only known happiness, and my children are settled and it's warm and lovely. And I didn't want to bring all that old emotion that I have dealt with and I have moved past into this life that I have here. So what I did instead, I travel quite a lot with work. And so I took those sections with me and I wrote them in anonymous hotel rooms where it didn't matter. Didn't matter if I cried. No one was going to question my tear-stained face. No one was going to sort of suddenly burst into the office with some great news from school or a question about where their PE kit is or, you know, whatever, because I was just in a city where no one knew me and it didn't matter and I could shut the door. So I would do that and I'd write that section, that chapter. It might only be a couple of paragraphs, but it was really important that I was immersed in it. I could write it, I could process how I felt, and then I could leave all that emotion behind and come home.
That's what I was just going to say. Leave that sadness in that hotel room or wherever you were.
Yeah, I kind of feel bad for the housekeepers now, the maids coming into that, all that bad energy.
All the tissues piled up. They're like, what happened here? Well, let's talk about the cover and the title. I would think it might have been difficult to decide what kind of cover you wanted to put on this book.
Oh, man, the conversations we had over this cover. So the title, first of all, it wasn't called this right from the start. So in my working manuscript, it was called Promises for Grief. And when my editor said, you know, what do you think about calling it I Promise It Won't Always Hurt Like This, which was, you know, a line in the book and very much what the book is about. And I really, really liked it. It was, I mean, it's quite long. It's quite a long title. It doesn't trip off the tongue like my fiction does, but I really like it because it's so heartfelt and so exactly what the book is about. It's like a kind of a gift to the reader. So once that was certain, then it was down to the covers. And so I feel bad saying this because obviously I'm British, but I didn't like the early concept ideas that came from the UK. They were sort of fine, but they didn't say what I wanted to say. And then my US team showed me the daffodils. And we were using daffodils in the UK, but in a very different way, in a very abstract way. And the US team had this bunch of daffodils. And I just loved them. I absolutely loved them. I loved how they were slightly imperfect, how they looked as though they'd just been kind of picked right out of the garden and gathered together and were being offered to me. And I thought about all the times that we give flowers to people when we don't know what to say. And it felt so completely right. So I really loved it. And I said to the UK team, can we work with this design? So I've got a cover that is very nearly the same in both countries. We've got different, slightly different colors. We're blue in the UK and an amazing sort of turquoise green in the US, which I adore. Slightly different color font. So that, you know, there are differences, but I really, really like it. And I think it will speak to readers when they see it on bookshelves.
I agree. And it ties in with one of your stories where someone showed up at your front door and was kind of almost hidden behind the flowers.
Yeah. I mean, that was really the sort of the start of all this was a woman who came to my door, a complete stranger, a few weeks after my son had died. And she'd brought these daffodils that she'd picked from her garden. They were still wet with dew from the grass. And she had come because she had also suffered a bereavement. Her own child had died many years before. And I guess someone had told her about me and given her my address. I mean, I have no idea how she found me. But she knocked on the door with these daffodils and she said, I promise it won't always hurt like this. And she came in and we talked and I privately didn't believe her. I just didn't. I didn't believe that it was possible to ever feel normal again. I actually felt in those early weeks as though I were physically shutting down, that my organs were having to work so hard to pump my blood and to process things and, you know, to force breath in and out, that they wouldn't be able to carry on doing that. And so I felt as though I were dying as well. And I thought, well, it's just not, you know, what she's saying is a lie. And I even thought, and I hate myself for even thinking this, but I remember thinking, well, if that's how you feel, then you can't have loved your son in the way I loved mine. Because if you had, you wouldn't be smiling and walking around to people's houses with daffodils. You wouldn't be able to do that. And so when on my son's anniversary, I realized how far I'd come, I started thinking about this daffodil woman and how, of course, she was right. And here I was all those years later, very much in a position where I could turn up at someone's house with a bunch of daffodils and promise them that it won't always hurt like this. And so that became the start of the book and really the reason for writing it. It's my way of paying it forward from that visit all those years ago.
And I guess that is one of those things that I love about looking at a book at the front end. Beautiful cover. I actually really like the title. I do feel like it's an easy one to remember because I do sometimes complain about titles that are just a bunch of words strung together, but that's not this at all. Like, this is an easy one. It makes a lot of sense. But then you read the book and it has just a whole nother meaning. Like, the reason the daffodils are there and the expression and all of it. I love that because it almost kind of comes full circle.
It does. And I love the symbolism as well with bulbs that we plant. You know, we plant them when everything feels a bit depressing. You know, we plant them in the autumn, winter's coming in, the nights are drawing in, and we shove these little things under the soil. And they're so nondescript, aren't they? They're just these sort of husky bits of kind of paper and skin. Anyway, we shove them under the earth and we leave them there. And somehow, over the winter, when we're all moaning about the cold and the wet, and feeling depressed because there's no sunlight, amidst all of that, they start growing. And then just as we've almost given up hope that we can't, you know, it feels like spring will never come, they start pushing their way through the surface. And by February, they're blooming. And I look into my garden now and I've got daffodil flowers, all these lovely, cheerful yellow heads nodding at me as I walk down the garden. And I love the fact that these bulbs are like a promise of better times ahead.
I agree. And they are so bright and cheery, you can't help but smile.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I always ask for reading recommendations at the end. And because we have been talking about grief, I would love to hear some of your recommendations for those that do want additional books. You have a great list in your book, but I'd love to talk a little bit about a title or two that you feel are useful or were useful to you.
Sure. I've read lots of books on grief. I've tried to read a lot more and sometimes they hit their mark and sometimes they don't. So a couple that have hit the mark for me are A Manual for Heartache by Kathy Rensenbrink, who lost her brother when she was a child and has lived with her grief ever since. It's so beautifully written. Kathy Rensenbrink has written novels. She's also written a very, very good book on how to write a memoir for anyone that feels that that would be a cathartic thing to do. But her own memoir, A Manual for Heartache, is really worth reading. The other memoir I really loved that I read more recently is by the Reverend Richard Coles, who lost his husband. His husband suffered from alcoholism and was very, very sick. And after he died, Richard Coles wrote The Madness of Grief. And it was the title that drew me to it because I do feel that it feels like a kind of insanity when you're suffering from grief. And he writes so beautifully about grief in its early stages. It's a very, very powerful and moving read. I actually listened to him read the audiobook and I really recommend that. But I'm also a big believer in fiction for processing our thoughts and emotions, and a book that not that many people have come across when I talk about this is called The Phone Box at the Edge of the World. It's by Laura Imai Messina, and it's translated from Japanese. Is it translated from Japanese? I might have made that up.
I'm not sure. I've heard of it, but I've never read it.
So it's a translation. I'm going to stick with that. And it is about a phone box where you can pick up the receiver and speak to people no longer with us. It's incredibly moving. It brought me so much comfort and I recommend it to everybody. So it's called The Phone Box at the Edge of the World by Laura Imai Messina.
Okay, good. I'm going to pick that one up. I remember when it came out in English and I thought, oh, that sounds so interesting, but I never read it. So that is very helpful. Thank you.
I think you would find it really comforting, Cindy. I really do.
Okay, great. The other series that I have found comforting is Before the Coffee Gets Cold. Have you read those?
Oh, no, but I have heard of it.
So there are four of them, and they are translated from the Japanese. And I've read two of the four because they're really kind of standalones. I've read book one and book four, and I have two and three. But it's a little cafe, and you can go in there and go back in time and talk to somebody. And I have found those to be incredibly helpful.
Oh, I love the sound of that. Okay, I'm going to get those. That sounds brilliant. I just thought of something. I know we're running out of time, but I found it really interesting to talk to my foreign editors about this book and about grief, because countries deal with, or societies deal with grief so differently. And so whereas in my fiction, I've been used to my books being translated in, you know, 40 languages, several countries haven't needed my memoir, and they've been quite sort of surprised that we would even think about needing a book on grief, because why would we need to have a book? You know, you express your grief, you talk to people, you cry. And so there are countries where it's just people just deal with grief better. I think in the UK and in the States that perhaps we work so hard at being strong and buttoned up and, you know, not just holding it together, that we're not very comfortable in talking about grief. And that's why we need books.
Okay, I actually love that your agent is going out trying to sell this book, and people are like, why would we need this book? We already are dealing with our grief. I love that. They're like, okay, I don't understand. That's really funny. It's always so interesting how those things work country to country, you know, because the covers are different. Sometimes the titles are different. And apparently sometimes you don't even need the book. So that's really funny. Well, Claire, I always love chatting with you. And I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today and helping me through a couple moments there. And I know that your book is going to resonate with so many readers. I mean, it already has. People were talking on Goodreads all about it and the things that it was really helping them with. And I'm glad that you wrote it.
It has been incredibly amazing to read the early reviews on this book. So yeah, I'm pleased I wrote it, and I hope it brings lots of comfort to lots of people.
Me too. I'm also really looking forward to you chatting with my Patreon group in March about A Game of Lies, which is just a phenomenal read as well.
Thank you so much.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I would love to connect with you on Instagram or Facebook, where you can find me at Thoughts From A Page. If you enjoy the show, please consider joining my Patreon group to access bonus content and support the podcast. If you have a moment to rate the show or subscribe to it wherever you listen to your podcasts, I would really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. And please tell all of your friends about Thoughts From A Page. Word of mouth does wonders to help the show grow. The book discussed in this episode can be purchased at my bookshop storefront, and the link is in the show notes. I hope you'll tune in next time.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.